Sí.
Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location.
Expands consciousness.
East of the Appalachians, our AccuWindow forecast 65 degrees and clear. Glad you could join us tonight. March 11, 2012. 2012 is counting down. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or at your computer working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about where we came from, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. This is where the past meets the future. If you want to be part of the program tonight, we encourage that. It's a three-hour program that ends all too quickly each Sunday evening between 5 and 8 p.m. Pacific time. If you didn't change your clocks 1 hour forward, you are obviously in a state of confusion. But that's okay, you're here now. Our number 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Also, if you plan on stepping out, all you have to do if you have an Android phone is click on the Android app icon at xsquaredradio.com. You can listen to this program live on your phone. As I get better writing apps, we'll eventually put a button on there so that you can press it while you're listening to the program and it will dial into the studio if you feel so moved. The solar wind actually doubled in speed over the last 4 days. It's now up to 520 kilometers per second, delivering a geomagnetic storm to our planet. The strongest since 2004. Sunspot AR-1429 has unleashed another strong flare, an M-class flare, day before yesterday. The blast hurled a coronal mass ejection almost directly toward Earth. There is another one on its way right behind that. We'll be here tomorrow. According to analysts at Goddard Space Weather Lab, M-class flares are a wavelength that can cause highly charged particles to be absorbed by metal, such as wire. The same eruption that hurled the CME toward Earth also produced a monstrous tsunami of plasma on the sun. NASA's SDO recorded the shadowy but powerful wave ripping away from the blast site. The tsunami was about, get this, 100,000 kilometers high and raced outward at a speed of 250 kilometers per second with a total energy of about 2 teratons of TNT. Such waves often underlie coronal mass ejections like the one en route to Earth now. At first, the widely reported CME impact of March 8th, which was 3 days ago, produced little in the way of Earth effects. Awesome, awesome auroras have been recorded all over the Northern Hemisphere. Eventually, however, a geomagnetic storm did develop as Earth passed through the wake of the CME. Mild to strong geomagnetic storms are underway around the Arctic Circle. We were worried a little bit because since the last one in 2004, we have become significantly more electrified in our society. We all use smartphones, even though we may or may not do dumb things with them. And we are more interconnected than ever. And so we are extremely sensitive as a society to activities from the sun. In fact, a solar storm can have pretty devastating effect. The sun hit us right in the nose, says Joe Kunches, a scientist from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. He called it the sun's version of Super Tuesday. Scientists say the sun has been relatively quiet for some time, even though the sunspots have been enormous, like double-barreled shotguns aimed at the planet. And this storm, while strong, may seem fiercer because Earth has been lulled by several years of weak solar activity. I told you, the calm before the storm. This is a good-sized event, but not the extreme type, said Bill Murtock, program coordinator for the Space Weather Center. The solar storm is likely to last through Friday morning, but the region that erupted can still send more blasts our way. There's one on its way right now. The actual solar wind speed was expected to get up to around 1,100 kilometers per second. It left the sun at 6.4 million kilometers per hour. But the actual speed is only about 585 at its peak. It's about 520 right now. It's not the strongest I've seen in the past 4 years. The magnetic part of the storm has the potential to trip electrical power grids. That's the real danger. Fortunately, very fortunately, all across the country, weather is mild. And the load on the grid is mild as well. Had it been in the middle of summer with air conditioners pumping away from coast to coast to try to avert three-digit temperatures, the grid would have been very sensitive to any kind of straw that might break the electric back of the grid. The timing and speed of the storm determines whether it knocks off power grids. In 1989, you'll remember, a strong solar storm knocked out the power grid in Quebec, causing 6 million people to lose power. Solar storms can also make global positioning systems less accurate, which is mostly a problem for precision drilling and other technologies, Kunches says. There also could be GPS outages. So if you're relying on your GPS to get you where you need to be, remember those things tap into 5, 6, sometimes 8 satellites to get a precise location. If the satellites are interrupted because they have to correct for all of the Doppler changes between where they are and how they're traveling around the Earth and where you are, you know, it's just a little bit of, you know, lens mechanics there. Don't go into that. But theoretically, the system shouldn't work, but it does. Sort of like bumblebees flying. But they're sensitive to solar activity. Storm can also cause communication problems and added radiation around the North and South Poles, which will probably force airlines to reroute flights. You might be delayed coming back from Europe because they won't take the polar route. They'll fly somewhat south of that. Some have already done that. NASA spokesman Rob Navias said the space agency isn't taking any extra precautions to protect astronauts on the International Space Station from added radiation. Now, this program tonight, we're going to get into some economic science and also into some political science. We don't do conspiracy theories here, but when the evidence is overwhelming, when the conclusions that we can draw from that evidence lead us to, you know, empower us to take precautions and put ourselves in a different position so we're sort of out of the way of the, you know, things that have fallen off the top shelf, then we're going to cover them. So I'm going to cover a little bit of economic science here. One of the things that has affected most Americans in some way or another, even if you only have a 401k and own your property outright, is this wave of foreclosures that we have gone through. We haven't talked about it much on this program, but I have some evidence tonight I want to share with you, which is really going to enlighten you. If I know you're interested in this and you may not have all the facts, you won't get them all tonight, but you'll have more than you had, which will give you a very good balance for where you need to go in the next 12 to 18 months. If you have friends, you might want to give them a call because the next 3 hours are going to put you in connection with forces at work very high up that you can get out of the way of when they come tumbling down as they wrestle with each other. Boom era property speculators, believe it or not, are going to get foreclosure aid. That's right. Real estate speculators are going to be bailed out. The Obama administration will extend mortgage assistance for the first time ever to investors who bought multiple homes before the market imploded, helping some speculators who drove up prices and inflated the housing bubble. As it turns out, real estate inflation helps the market because it helps the banks be able to justify the loans that they're giving out for the homes. Landlords can now qualify for up to 4 federally subsidized loan workouts starting around May. That gives you a couple of months to get ready, you slumlords, as long as they rent out each house or have plans to fill them under the revamped Home Affordable Modifications Program, also known as HAMP. You know, the government, they love their acronyms. According to Timothy Massad, the Treasury Assistant Secretary for Financial Stability, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Mr. Massad in a moment. For those of you who don't know who this is, you're about to. Timothy G. Massad was confirmed June 30th of 2011 by the United States Senate after being appointed by President Obama to serve as the Department of the Treasury's Assistant Secretary for Financial Stability. Have you seen any stability lately? In this role, Timothy, we'll just call him Massad because I like the word, is responsible for overseeing the implementation and wind down of the Troubled Asset Relief Program. You know this as TARP. You remember those pesky TARP funds, don't you? Bailed out the banks and the banks paid it back, then mysteriously it disappeared. Massad previously served as the Acting Assistant Secretary for Financial Stability. The acting assistant. Now he's really not acting anymore. You know, he is the real secretary. You know what I'm talking about, right?
I am. I'm a dude playing a dude disguised as another dude.
That's right. He's a dude playing a dude disguised as another dude. Prior to joining Treasury, Massad was a partner with the law firm of Cravath, Swain & Moore, LLP, in New York. No, you probably don't know who that is. He had a diverse corporate practice with an emphasis on corporate finance. But you're going to be interested to know his specialty was international transactions and representation of some of the firm's corporate clients. From 1998 to 2002, he was the co-manager of the firm's Hong Kong office, where he was involved in transactions throughout Asia, including in particular India and China. He also worked in the firm's London office. He is intimately involved with foreign finance, valuation, and collateralization. The program pays banks to reduce monthly payments by cutting interest rates, which has been done, stretching terms, that's called taking your payments today and putting them on the back of the loan, and even forgiving principal. Well, I have to tell you, at no time in history has the principal for homeowners, private or otherwise, been forgiven by the banks. And it's not being forgiven here. Don't fool yourself. Taxpayers are picking up the bill. Investors are central to the federal government's strategy for reviving real estate, with home prices down 34% since July of 2006. Maybe that didn't hit home. 34% since July of 2006. And as foreclosures deplete the pool of buyers who can qualify for a mortgage because their credit has now been slaughtered, these investors are the most plentiful of the upper middle class and make up the bulk of millionaires in America. These investors are central to the federal government's strategy for reviving real estate, with home prices down 34%. And as foreclosures deplete the pool of buyers who can qualify for a mortgage, these are the guys. They are also the key to the administration's reelection effort. and these individuals are heavy contributors to political campaigns and occupy most of the local government and bank board positions. The governments need to protect neighborhoods from blight. Blight is where a neighborhood might be infected with empty homes, you know, grass growing up, no curtains in the windows kind of stuff, and renters from eviction by keeping the current owners in place is outweighing concern that taxpayers will end up bailing out real estate investors. I reckon so. The program is being enlarged after less than 1 million borrowers modified loans through HAMP, compared with the administration's stated goal in 2009 of helping 3 million to 4 million homeowners. Why didn't they jump on board? Because the regulations and guidelines were so complicated that virtually no one accessed the program. Less than 3% of banks even knew about the program. Quote, when we started the program, we focused on owner-occupied houses because the need was so great and we wanted to target the efforts to that group, said Massad. Given where we are today, more and more people recognize that vacant properties are a problem, no matter how they became vacant. Well, the first issue is the home ownership rate. Many of you might not be familiar with this, but it is kind of key to the American dream, you know, owning a home. Investors are central, of course, to the federal government's strategy of, you know, keeping the economy going. It has been the American way since the founding of the colonies that people always buy more home than they can presently afford, and then they grow their earning power to accommodate the home they own. Come on, people want to own the biggest, nicest house in the nicest place that they can possibly afford with their current income, betting that tomorrow is always going to be better than today, you're going to earn more money, and the value of the property will continue to climb. It's always been that way since the first spade was put into the ground on this continent. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, told home builders in Orlando, Florida last month that the U.S. economy recovery has been frustratingly slow. I'll just let that sink in for a moment, in part because weak housing markets are holding back consumer spending. Hello? This is utter and complete nonsense and shows that Mr. Bernanke has no clue how economics work. People are holding back their spending because the agency-driven government is holding back their ability to earn a living. Hundreds of regulations per day are leaving small businesses behind in the learning curve. Do you know that single-location businesses are at an all-time high and growing every day? This is not driven by innovation, my friends. It is driven by the American desperation to provide for ourselves. These people cannot find a job, so they create a job, one for themselves. It's not an investment per se, it is a job that earns enough to pay the bills and raise kids. There is no 40-hour week anymore for these people. There's no family vacation. There's no new home being built by these people. There's only work and fear that the government will come in and take everything they have and then bail out the bank that repossessed it from them after the owner had built up all the equity by making payments for years. The proof is in the numbers. You know, I'm a statistician, so you're about to hear some, and there is no one to blame except the agency-driven government. The home ownership rate, which peaked at 69.2% in June of 2004, that would be under Bush, fell to 66% in the fourth quarter of 2011. This is not the trend we wanted to see, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. A new Fannie Mae program designed to reduce the overhang of foreclosed homes is encouraging potential buyers, including private equity firms, to purchase properties at a huge discount, by the way, in bulk and convert them to rentals. Almost one in four home purchases in January was made by an investor. Same thing happened in 1929 when the stock market crashed and the value of homes fell with it. People with cash, we call them investors, moved in and scooped up prime properties at pennies on the dollar. Of course, this is according to the National Association of Realtors. An investment in vacation properties make up 21% of houses in the foreclosure process in January, according to Irvine, California-based Realty Track, Inc. Who wouldn't want a cheap vacation home in Southern California? Well, this represents the huge change. Hold on one moment while I take in some grapefruit juice. You remember that word, don't you? Change that you can count on. The Obama administration announced last month that it would triple incentives to owners of mortgages that reduced home loan debt and expand eligibility to borrowers struggling under the weight of other liabilities, such as medical bills. They had to be certain kinds of bills, you know, bills slightly out of your control, like taxes or medical bills, then you could qualify for this program if you got behind. The extension will apply to all loans, including those held by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the government-sponsored mortgage financiers. About 700,000 landlords will be eligible under the revision to HAMP, which has been plagued by consumer complaints about lost paperwork, servicer delays, and restrictive eligibility requirements. This is a huge change, said Dan Immergluck. Immergluck. No, that really is his name, Immergluck. Couldn't possibly be married. A housing policy professor at Georgia Institute of Technology, the excessive concern to make sure nobody who played any role in creating the problem gets any benefit has paralyzed the response. Does that sentence make any sense to you at all? Yes, it does. They want to make sure nobody who played any role in creating the problem. How about that? And how did they determine who had a role in creating the problem? Who gets the blame? That's right. The banks get the blame. And they get the money. The Real Estate Brokers Association gets the blame for overappraising homes to get the loans bought from their banks. And they got the commissions, of course, without penalty. They don't have to pay those back. The government got the tax money and wrote the regulations, forcing the subprime credit onto the market in the first place, and then incentivized the entire program by promising to bail out the banks when the loans predictably went underwater, when the appraisal inflation bubble burst. The sale of homes has not been driven by demand for 30 years. It has been driven by the difference between the appraised value and the loaned value. It's called the loan-to-value, LTV. When it's high, homes sell like mad because the loan is collateralized. When the value is low, they don't qualify for loans without huge down payments. The danger of a blight to communities from foreclosed vacant properties is still pervasive 6 years into the slump. Empty houses push down a neighborhood's property values, according to a 2009 report by the Center for Responsible Lending. We call that the mother-in-law, you know, the Center for Responsible Lending, which said foreclosures will affect, and I've got this underlined because it's important. You need to pay attention to this. Foreclosures will affect 91.5 million nearby homes through 2012. That's not one home per person. There are an average of 3.2 people per home in America. That's kind of low if you think about it. That means there are nearly 300 million Americans who have been affected by a foreclosure. There are only about 335 million people, men, women, and children, who are not homeowners in America to begin with, which means a foreclosure near you affects you. Either they have lost a home or the value of their home has been diminished by a sale of a foreclosed home near them. That will reduce property values by an average of $20,300 for each household, sometimes more, according to the group, which seeks to protect home ownership and family wealth, which is definitely the largest investment homeowners, or actually individuals, will make in their lifetime, usually, is their home. Yeah, they can seek all they want, but there is a real value that is set not by the bricks and nails it took to build the home, but by the ever-inflating appraisal game played by the Real Estate Brokers Association. By the way, most real estate brokers are also builders, officials in the American Home Builders Association, and they sit on the boards of banks all over America. Now, do you see the picture? These are the very same high net worth individuals who buy politicians and elections. Now, let's talk a little bit about these buy and flip investors. The game is fueled only when comparable sales, that's what the appraiser does, look for comparable sales of your home, your size, and your neighborhood with your amenities, so they can tell the future buyer of your home what it's worth. When comparable sales are registered at the courthouse, each increase in sale allows the appraised value to be inflated for the next home to sell. By widening the agency-driven government program, the plan will inevitably offset aid or offer aid to buy and flip investors who pushed prices higher during the boom by taking out mortgages with little or no down payment. You remember those late night infomercials, don't you? Nothing down? Put millions of dollars in your pocket by buying real estate? Those commercials? Well, that's where it came from. That's where the buy and flip investor came from. Drive the neighborhoods, find one where the grass has grown up, maybe no curtains in the windows, find out who owns it, make them an offer, low. Take the house, mow the lawn, paint the house, do some carpet, flip the house for a $20,000 or $30,000 profit. More millionaires have been made doing this than any other thing you can imagine. Speculators accelerated the crash because they were quick to default when prices fell. According to the September report from Andrew Howitt, Dongboom Lee, Joseph Tracy, and Wilbert Van der Klauw of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. None of these guys sound like local boys. Don't be too quick to judge them. Speculators are not the right word here. Income-producing property owners are the right term. They owned more than one home or unit, and they rented it out. When the unemployment goes up, people cannot pay their rent. When they cannot pay their rent, the owners cannot pay their mortgages. That's how it happens. Property owners cannot print money to pay their mortgages. And if they had significant equity, the banks are lightning fast snatching those properties and selling them. At the peak of the boom in 2006, more than a third of home purchase loans were made to borrowers who already owned at least one house. A third of home loans were made to people who are buying a second or third home, according to the study. In California, Florida, Nevada, and Arizona, which had the most pronounced bubbles, investors accounted for 45% of the mortgages. These were not the bubbles, and they know it. There are more millionaires in America from real estate than any other form of business. It comes from the best collateral in history, single-family dwellings. Not everyone can qualify for a home loan, so investors buy homes and feed the demand for rental homes. If it wasn't for their entrepreneurial risk-taking, America would be just like Europe. We'd be living in apartments. While survivors of the property bust are now long-term investors, some of them may have started out as flippers. Now, let's see how taxpayer dollars are included in this amazing program. You know, this was all predicted. We all knew that eventually homes just can't keep going up and up and up in value. I mean, how many of you have taken a vacation in California just for the heck of it? While you're there at the Denny's restaurant, you pick up the local Homes for Sale magazine, and you're looking at these nice 12, 15, 1800 square foot houses for $500,000, $750,000, $1 million. You're raising your eyebrows as you force your sunny side egg down your neck and say, holy cow, who could afford a $1 million home? Well, while speculators are no one's first priority for receiving taxpayer dollars, providing assistance to a large class of multiple property owners and blanket modifications offered regardless of occupancy would be more efficient than restrictive programs, the Fed said in the September report. Chandrajit Bhattacharya, an analyst at Credit Suisse Group AG in New York, said that the HAMP changes will result in about 200,000 modifications for investors. While it won't keep bondholders up at night, it will probably slow the process of liquidating foreclosed homes. Bhattacharya said he doesn't understand why the government should be subsidizing workouts for property investors who are in the business of making money on their purchases. Vacancies are unlikely to increase if the houses go into foreclosure and are purchased by owner-occupants or new investors who fill them with tenants, he said. This is what we call an adjustment, a reset. In other words, if the houses go back, or if the flippers or long-term investors, as they choose to call them, decide to sell the homes, they're probably going to sell them at a discount, barely profit, just to get out from underneath the mortgage, you know, keep their credit clean, which means somebody's going to get a deal. And it happens all the time. Young people who in years past have only been able to afford a starter home are now able to afford a home that we would call a move-up home, because the prices have come down so much. Neighborhoods where homes sell for $120,000, $130,000, you can, if you're in the right place at the right time, pick up a home for $65,000 or $70,000. You know the real estate market's going to come back. So those young people have a great first leg up on a good future. Well, I don't know why Bhattacharya can't understand that. That is the reset. I personally met a man who owns more than 760 apartments in Houston, Texas, and they're only 35% occupied, and he's looking for federal relief so he won't lose his investment. Now, does that sound like a ridiculous policy to you? Well, John Burns, an Irvine, California-based real estate consultant, said it's ridiculous for taxpayers to come to the aid of individuals who made bad bets. The bubble was not created by the person who ended up with the home. It was created by the appraiser who certified the value of the home. There's only so much wood and concrete in any home. A home built with $120,000 in wood, bricks, and paint simply cannot bear the value of $1 million like you'll find in California or Boston or even Franklin, Tennessee. What kind of precedent are you going to set? Burns said. Exactly right, Mr. Burns. Are you going to refund people who lost money on the stock market too? You got it. Who in the agency can set a formula for the equity offset? I will guarantee you this, Earth Explorers. Whatever the number, the smart investor and his consultants will get in first, figure out a way to cheat the system, and bankrupt the fund for everyone else without the slightest bit of remorse. Government help to homeowners comes after President George W. Bush's administration rescued banks with the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, in 2008, when the housing crash sparked the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. Wall Street benefited from Federal Reserve emergency programs to keep credit flowing, while Bush and President Barack Obama directed federal money to save companies, including General Motors and Chrysler. The Obama administration then pursued a series of programs meant to reduce foreclosures. Keep in mind that the only loser in these home foreclosures was the taxpayer. The bank cannot ever lose a penny. They hold the deed to the property as collateral, remember? The value of the home is the value of the asset. Any action that takes place to reduce the length of that mortgage earns the bank more yield, not less. The appraised value of the home may be low now, but real estate always comes back, even if it takes 10 years, because the appraisers must increase the value steadily in order for the industry to survive. The bank itself is completely insulated against loss because it and it alone holds all the assets. It got your money for the payments, it got the interest on the loan, which it borrowed, and it owns the deed. Banks only lose money through investment securities and money market losses. That's the only way they can lose money, exactly the way it was in 1928 when Hoover became president. The cover, Earth Explorers, is not for the home foreclosures. The cover for the losses from is from cash trading and securities investments the banks make with your money when the bank closes each evening. The bank earns no money on its own. It uses your money to trade in currencies called the money market and through the margin on securities. They also call this shorting. I'll tell you more about that in the next hour. John Russell, who's 61, and he lives in Northville, Michigan, said he was never a speculator seeking to flip houses. He bought 4 rental properties in neighborhoods in the state more than 10 years ago, which means he's been making his payments for 10 years, and he planned to keep them for decades more. That was his retirement. Each home is probably worth a couple $100,000 now, but in 20 years, they'll be worth a lot more money. They'll be paid off, and he'll have an income stream in addition to his Social Security. Now, the houses are worth less than he owes, even after making payments for 10 years. His rents have tumbled, and he has to spend about $20,000 a year of his own money to keep them operating. He still has a job. It was never part of the plan to absorb more than a 10% vacancy rate. People make real estate investments betting on a 10% vacancy rate, 20 tops. But when the vacancy rate gets over that, or the amount of rent income that you take in drops to a certain point, you have to start subsidizing those payments with your paycheck. Yeah, that's why we don't call buying real estate a job, an investment. We call it a job. Now, you heard mention of the GM and the Chrysler bankruptcy. Lots of you know about the GM bankruptcy, but not many of you know about the Chrysler bankruptcy. And this is where it gets pretty interesting, because this bankruptcy went so clean and so smooth and so absent from the mainstream media that it is very telling when you go into the details. Russell, a retired Chrysler executive whose pension was cut during the automaker's 2009 bankruptcy, said 2 houses are in foreclosure and he can't afford to keep them without the federal government's help. Banks have repeatedly rejected him for a modification because they aren't primary residences, he said. Russell said he simply wants his mortgage bills to be brought back in line with the rents. In other words, he wants the taxpayer to pay a little bit off on his house so he can bring his mortgage size down to match what people can afford to pay for rent. I guess what you're always asking yourself is the market going to come back, Russell said. As an investor, you want to think that someday the house will be worth more than it is today. That's kind of the American dream, Russell. Lots of people with you. So Moose Sheeb, chief executive officer of LoanMod.com, a Dearborn, Michigan-based firm that advises homeowners facing foreclosure, said many of the investors who hung on through housing busts are mom-and-pop property owners who bought real estate as a source of retirement income. Must have been watching those late-night infomercials. Russell's one of his clients. Our economy is in trouble. Housing is in trouble, Sheeb said. Whether you're fixing it on behalf of investors or homeowners, it benefits everybody to do that. Of course. Of course the owners will come out better. The taxpayers will get stuck, but the homeowners will come out great. Also, you need to know that Chrysler went to Obama and told him they were going to go bankrupt. And they requested help in the restructuring process. Many of you may know this name from the press, but you're about to hear the rest of the story here. Obama appointed a man named Stephen Ratner as the car czar. Stand by. You have never heard this, and it will tell you what really went on with the Chrysler bankruptcy. This is what's going on beneath the waves, beneath the smiles, beneath the hand waving and the every other day fundraisers. I think there are 4 to 5 fundraisers a week now. Behind all of the primaries and behind all the pundits and the perfectly complected spokespeople that are out there telling you things are getting better. Stephen L. Ratner is a financier who led the Obama administration's efforts to restructure the auto industry. He stepped down from that post in July of 2009 as he became embroiled in a scandal involving New York State's pension fund. In November 2010, Mr. Ratner agreed to pay $6.2 million in repayments and penalties to settle a suit brought by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The settlement also banned him from associating with any investment advisor or broker-dealer for 2 years. Bad boy, Mr. Ratner. On December 30th, Mr. Ratner reached a settlement with Andrew M. Cuomo, 2 days before Mr. Cuomo shifted from being New York's attorney general to its governor. Mr. Cuomo had filed 2 suits against him, seeking at least $26 million from Mr. Ratner and a lifetime ban from the securities industry in New York. The suits charged that the Quadrangle Group, the private equity firm formerly headed by Mr. Ratner, paid kickbacks to win lucrative contracts managing assets of the pension fund. In other words, he used pension funds. These are monies that New York workers entrusted the fund so that it would be there when they reached 62.5 years old and they would then have the money to retire themselves on. Mr. Ratner put the pension fund at risk, investing in things that he made healthy commissions on using those pension funds. Quadrangle also struck a deal with both Mr. Cuomo and the SEC paying $12 million to end its role in the case. They settled out of court. Nobody wanted this to come out. The firm acknowledged paying more than $1 million in fees to a political consultant, Hank Morris, in exchange for his help in landing a state investment contract. Mr. Morris pleaded guilty to security fraud. The battle between Mr. Ratner and Mr. Cuomo, two of New York's most powerful Democrats, grew intense before the settlement was reached. Mr. Cuomo considered perjury charges against Mr. Ratner, and Mr. Ratner called Mr. Cuomo's behavior close to extortion. Reporting by the New York Times revealed a previously undisclosed 2007 meeting in which Mr. Ratner first provided his account to Mr. Cuomo's investigators about how the Quadrangle Group had obtained a $150 million investment from the New York Pension Fund. That account, investigators said, was later undercut by Mr. Ratner's own emails, enraging Mr. Cuomo, who had extended Mr. Ratner deference and immunity from criminal prosecution. Mr. Ratner, a longtime Wall Street dealmaker, now works at Willett Advisors, the personal money management arm of his close friend, Michael R. Bloomberg, the billionaire mayor of New York. The Attorney General's settlement will have no effect on Mr. Ratner's current work. The SEC's 2-year ban currently prohibits him from being paid by Willett and participating in some investment activities at the firm. I am sure Mr. Ratner's wages are being banked somewhere else. Mr. Ratner, whose personal net worth was $188 million to $608 million, according to a 2009 disclosure filing, spent much of the late 2010 promoting his book on the restructuring of General Motors and Chrysler. For Mr. Cuomo, the settlement let him avoid having a motivated enemy in Mr. Ratner, who, despite being brought low by his involvement in the scandal, continues to hold influence in New York's financial, political, and media circles. Remember, he is one of the wealthiest Democrats in the state of New York. He is also a heck of a deal maker. For years, Mr. Ratner has cultivated a reputation as a major player in New York's political and charity circles. Though he is less known in Washington and Detroit, Mr. Ratner was a financial reporter for the New York Times who entered investment banking in the 1980s, becoming a deal maker in the media and communications sector for the likes of Lehman Brothers, Morgan Stanley, and Lazard. Now, pay close attention to that. In the 1980s, he was a reporter for the New York Times. I'm sure that's one of the top paying jobs in the entire state of New York. Not. In 2010, he is worth over $188 million. Not bad, Mr. Ratner. In 2000, he co-founded Quadrangle, a media-focused private equity firm, which means basically they're market makers. They use media to build hype on companies in order to influence investment. In January 2008, just as Mr. Obama was being inaugurated, Mayor Michael Bloomberg chose the firm to manage the investments of his multi-billion dollar fortune. Mr. Ratner has long harbored political ambitions. A longtime Democrat contributor, he backed Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton's presidential campaign. You remember that thing about your friends and your enemies? Keep your friends close, your enemies closer. And some speculated that he sought the Treasury Secretary post in a Clinton administration. His wife, Maureen White, was Mrs. Clinton's finance co-chairperson. In 2009, just a year later, after, of course, the election results were in, Mr. Ratner counseled Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and Lawrence Summers, the director of the National Economic Council, on reorganization efforts by General Motors and Chrysler. Two car makers were receiving federal bailout money. Mr. Ratner was one of 14 people on a committee orchestrating the rescue of the giant automakers. Still, he played a central role, advising the White House on which companies seemed salvageable and how. Now, this really hasn't gotten a lot of airplay. I don't even think there were many books written about it, but you're going to hear about it right here. We have about 5 minutes left in this hour, so when the next hour starts, I'm going to tell you about a scandal of epic proportions that will make Watergate look like a fence gate. This is really going to shake your faith in everything governmental, if you had any faith left. The interesting thing about this entire fiasco is people that you would think would never work with one another, hardly trustworthy at all, already have a long reputation of subterfuge to get where they are the very people who rose to power, the very people that rose to heavy notoriety in what's going on in our current administration. I don't want to even call it the White House because it isn't. It's more of an agency-run government. It's not interesting. It's infuriating. So we'll play a little break. We'll take about a five-minute break here in about 4 minutes. Our phone number is 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Don't forget to click on the Android app. You'll see the little postage stamp right there on the cover of xsquaredradio.com. This will download that logo as an app to your phone. And when you want to listen to PBS Radio and hopefully X Squared Radio, you just click on that app and you'll be listening right through the Bluetooth hanging over your ear. Also, as you're making your plans this year, some of you have already filed for that refund check where you gave that interest-free loan to the government for 12 months. Don't spend it all in one place, because there are two things that might interest you One is the Maya 2012 conference. You got a passport or you want one? You want to be at Ground Zero in Chichen Itza on December 21st, 2012? That's where it's going to be happening. Power Places is putting on a conference there. Myself, Maureen St. Germain, David Braden, many, many speakers from around the world are going to be there. And it's going to be from December 13th through December 22nd. I promise to have you home by Christmas. You will have stories to tell that will make all your meetings for the next 5 years go over. This is the place to be, Maya 2012. All you have to do is click on the orange banner at xsquaredradio.com. Go ahead and get your deposit in. I know you think it's 9 months away, but it sneaks up. It isn't terrifically cheap, but it's also not hugely expensive for what you're going to get. You make your way to Houston, and we'll get you the rest of the way, all the way there and all the way back. All the hotels, meals, everything. So why don't you come and join us? Strong rumor has it that Sting and Carlos Santana are going to be playing in the same venue. We haven't firmed that up yet, but no one's denying it. They made an announcement a couple of months ago, and we're sticking to it. Also, if you don't have a passport, you don't want to travel to Mexico, you want some place that you can drive to instead of fly to, I have a solution for you. Southern Indiana, at a very nice resort, will be the Pythagoras Conference. Now, there will be 50 world-class speakers there, some royalty from around the world, coming there to speak. This is a Midwest location, people. Southern Indiana, just above the Kentucky border. Not only is it affordable, I'm making it even better for you. If you go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the blue Pythagoras Conference banner, you get another $100 off. Now, it's affordable. It's within an easy day's drive from almost anywhere in the country, 73% of the population. But the value is going to be great. Several days, you will come away, not with a workshop high, but with a life change. So that's the place to be. Don't forget Pythagoras Conference, the blue banner, xsquaredradio.com. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away. Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast: 52 degrees and clear. Mars bright and red in the sky. We love it. Welcome. Welcome to X Squared Radio. So appreciative of you being here with us. Of course, you know the BBS Radio Network is arguably the largest, most amazing webcast radio network on the web in the world. And X Squared Radio is the number one program on that network. So you know you're in the right place. The topics we're covering tonight are surely controversial, but definitely not conspiratorial in nature. These are the facts, my friends. I might throw my own humor, my own imagination on it, but you know where I'm coming from. I want you to be part of it. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Don't forget about the Android app. I am working on the Windows app. And I'm working on the Apple app. I'm having trouble with the Apple app, not the code, but the certifications. Apple is not too user-friendly when it comes to the certifications. I've paid my money and I've filed over and over and over again, but Apple doesn't recognize the file type. So there has to be a trick to it. I've paid a couple of people in the know and no solutions yet. But if it can be figured out, we'll figure it out because we specialize in the impossible here at X Squared Radio. And occasionally, we deliver miracles. So you're in the right place because you never know what you're going to hear here. That's just the way it is. Yes, yes, that's right. Second hour of X Squared Radio. Yes, we're glad you're here with us. I can hear you all out there. You want to email me? It's simple. bagnew@x2-radio. bagnew@x2-radio. I answer every single email, no matter how many come in. I appreciate you. All right. This could be a scandal of epic proportions and one that makes Nixon's Watergate look like a fence gate, or Clinton's Monica Lewinsky affair pale by comparison. Why was there neither rhyme nor reason as to which dealerships of the Chrysler Corporation were to be closed? I know you've probably been thinking about that since Chrysler filed bankruptcy in 2009. Well, roll the clock back to the weeks just before Chrysler declared bankruptcy. Chrysler, like GM, was in dire financial straits, and federal government graciously offered to buy the company and keep them out of bankruptcy and save jobs. Chrysler was, in the words of Obama and his administration, too big to fail. Same story with GM, but the feds organized their automotive task force to fix Chrysler and GM. Obama, in an act that is 100% unconstitutional, absolutely positively unconstitutional and illegal, appointed a guy named Steve Rattner. If you're just tuning in, go back and listen to the last part of the last hour and you'll read about Steve Rattner's resume. Formerly a New York Times reporter, obviously one of the top paying jobs in the entire state of New York, because a mere 20 years later, Mr. Rattner is worth over $200 million and is rocking and rolling with the likes of Cuomo and Geithner and Bloomberg. Anyway, he's appointed to be the White House official car czar, literally. That's what his title was, car czar. Rattner is the liaison between Obama and Chrysler and, of course, GM. Initially, the national media reported that Chrysler had made this list of dealerships, you know. But that's absolutely not true. That's correct. The national media reported a made-up lie, a falsehood, subterfuge. Chrysler did not make a list of dealerships. The Washington Examiner, Newsmax, Fox News, and a host of other news agencies discovered that the list of dealerships was fabricated by the Automotive Task Force, headed by no one other than Mr. Steve Rattner. That's right. Now, the plot thickens. Remember earlier we said that there was neither rhyme nor reason why certain dealerships were closed. Well, actually, there was a very interesting pattern as to who was closed. Again, on May 27th, my birthday, 2009, the Washington Examiner and Newsmax exposed the connection. Amazingly, stunningly, of the 789 dealerships closed by the federal government's car czar, Mr. Steven Rattner, all but one, 788 of them had donated money exclusively to Republican political causes while contributing nothing to Democratic political causes. The only Democrat dealership on the list was found to have donated $7,700 to Hillary's campaign and a bit over $2,000 to John Edwards. This is the same dealership reportedly who gave $200 to Obama's campaign. Wasn't quite enough. They got on the list too. Of course, there's more to it because this dealership happened to be in Denver. There are two Democrat owned Chrysler dealerships in Denver. Now there's only one because the other one donated more than $100,000 to Obama's campaign. Yeah, that's the one that's still there. The other one, of course, was closed. Steve Rattner is the guy who put the list together. Well, he happens to be married to Maureen White. I told you this. Maureen happened to be the former national finance chairman of the Democratic National Committee, DNC. You know, as such, she has access to campaign donation records from everyone in the nation, Republican or Democrat. But of course, this is just a coincidence, I'm sure. Then comes another really strange coincidence. No, these are not conspiracy theories. These are facts, my friends. Direct observations, ones for which there is direct evidence, should an investigation ever be done on the largest financial bailout in American history. On that list of dealerships being closed down, a very weird thing happened in Arkansas, North Louisiana, and Southern Missouri. It seems that Bill Clinton's former White House chief of staff, Jack McClarty, you remember Mr. McClarty, don't you? He owns a chain of dealerships in that region, partnered with a fellow by the name of Robert Johnson. Johnson happens to be founder of Black Entertainment Television and was a huge Obama supporter and financier. These guys own a half a dozen Chrysler stores under the title RLJ McClarty Landers. Interestingly, none of their dealerships were ordered closed. Not one. While all of their competing Chrysler, Dodge, and Jeep dealerships were closed. Eight dealerships located near the dealerships owned by McClarty and Johnson were ordered closed. Thus, by pure luck, I'm sure, these two major Obama supporters now have virtual monopolies on Chrysler sales in their zone. Isn't that amazing? Go look in the Washington Examiner. The story's there. And it's in a dozen or so other web-based news organizations. It just isn't being made up right here on this program tonight. Now, if you thought Chrysler was owned by Fiat, you're mistaken. Under the federal court ruling, 65% of Chrysler is now owned by the federal government and the United Auto Workers Union Fiat owns 20%. The other 15% is still privately owned and presumably will be traded on the stock market. Obama smiles and says he doesn't want to run the auto industry. As as horrifying as this is to comprehend. And being as how this used to be the United States of America, you know, that republic, it would appear that the president has the power to destroy private businesses and eliminate upwards of 100,000 jobs just because they don't agree with his political agenda. This doesn't resemble the America I know. Obama has 32 personally appointed czars. No advice and consent by the Senate. No advice and consent by the Congress. No person in this republic had any say-so whatsoever. They only answer to him. They all are acting without any constitutional authority. But hey, we're sure they all have unique skills, as Tim Geithner likes to say. Also, in a related story, don't forget, you know, it's not just car dealerships. It's not just homes that are being cut down with the sickle of government. Banks are also foreclosing on churches. That's right. Banks are foreclosing on America's churches in record numbers as lenders increasingly lose patience with religious facilities that have defaulted on their mortgages, according to new data. Well, doesn't that sound quaint? Wouldn't you like to know the facts? Yes, you would. Here they are. The surge in church foreclosures represents a new wave of distressed property seizures triggered by the 2008 financial crash. By the way, 2008, there was a presidential election. You remember that election. With many banks no longer willing to grant struggling religious organizations forbearance. Since 2010, 270 churches have been sold after defaulting on their loans, with 90% of those sales coming after a lender-triggered foreclosure, according to the real estate information company CoStar Group. In 2011, 138 churches were sold by banks, an annual record, with no sign that these religious foreclosures are abating. That compares to just 24 sales in 2008. 24. We're talking a tenfold increase in foreclosures on churches. Well, the church foreclosures have hit all denominations across America, black and white, but with small to medium-sized houses of worship, the worst. Most of these institutions have ended up being purchased by other churches. Of course, it's a single-purpose building in many cases. A chapel makes a difficult bedroom, I would say. The highest percentage have occurred in some of the states hardest hit by home foreclosure crisis, of course, California, Georgia, Florida, Michigan, etc. Churches are among the final institutions to get foreclosed upon because banks have not wanted to look like they are being heavy-handed with the churches. Oh, surely not. A tenfold increase in 4 years, heavy-handed? No, I don't think so. Church defaults differ from residential foreclosures. Most of the loans in question are not 30-year mortgages. They are commercial loans that typically mature after just 5 years when the full balance becomes due immediately. It's called a 5-year note, people. Normally what happens is every 5 years the bank refinances the note. Sometimes the church pays off a lot in those 5 years if they have a lot of worshipers who are doing really well and they have a great preacher. And sometimes they don't. They just pay the interest or sometimes nothing. It's just automatically refinanced at the end of 5 years. It's common practice for the banks to do this. But banks have become increasingly reluctant to do that because of pressure from regulators, that would be the agency-driven government, to clean up their balance sheets. The problem is not so much the church building value has been cyclic for over 100 years. The problem is twofold. First, banks are in financial trouble. Hundreds of smaller banks have been closed since 2008. You read about it almost every day in the newspaper. 10 banks here, 6 banks there, 20 banks here, 20 banks there. Florida, California, Tennessee, Texas, Georgia, Arkansas. Banks are being closed. While their marketable paper is bought up at face value, the commercial notes, like churches, are heavily discounted. Larger banks who are scooping up these often premium properties, large lots in high value districts at pennies on the dollar, while the taxpayer picks up the charge off. Quite the scam, don't you think? The second problem is that the tax law for charitable donations, closing the loophole for many lower and middle class families, is being eliminated. That's right. The loophole is being closed. When people cannot deduct the church donation from their taxes, and it's getting worse with each new Congress, the donations begin to fall off. This chokes the revenue for the church off, making it impossible for them to operate. Of course, the people will continue to be faithful, I'm sure, to donate their money to the church, even though the federal government limits how much of it they can take off on their taxes. It is now illegal for churches to charge for anything. They can't have a potluck fundraiser. They can't charge you for that breakfast. If they do so much as a car wash, if they do so much as a bake sale, they risk losing their tax-exempt status. The party war on religion has a broad front that makes it impossible for churches to flank the Fed. Oh yeah, one more thing. A tactic invented by none other than Abraham Lincoln in 1861 has slowly been rearing its head, its unconstitutional head. In 1861, Lincoln signed into law what was termed the Anti-Polygamy Act. Although it sounds like a good title, it enabled the federal government to limit church estates to $50,000. Church properties other than the actual chapel building were seized by the federal government. Their bank accounts were seized, and all the valuables in the buildings they seized were also confiscated. The Mormons sued and won in court, but never received their money or their valuables back. This federal action was not alone. Land reform is an act of governments to seize property for what they determine may be a higher use. Land reform is a deeply political process, and therefore many arguments for and against it have emerged. You know, that pesky little farmer down at the end of the line here that won't sell his property to allow the road to go through for the new mall or the new airport. He's holding out because his father owned that property and his father's father owned that property, and they came over on the whatever, whatever. That guy, let's just take his land. These arguments vary tremendously over time and place. For example, in the 20th century, many land reforms emerged from a particular political ideology, such as communism or socialism. That doesn't sound too familiar in this country, though, does it? Eminent domain is an act of seizure by government for property that it needs for municipal improvements, such as rights of way or industrial purposes. Thousands upon thousands of farms have been taken from families by towns, states, and the federal government without properly compensating those owners, and there's nothing they can do about it. Or as can be seen in the 19th century in colonized states, a colonial government may have changed the laws dictating land ownership to better consolidate political power or to support its colonial economy. In more recent times, electoral mobilization and the use of land as a patronage resource have been proposed as possible motivations for land reform efforts, such as the extensive redistributive land reforms of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. In point of fact, American property ownership is under a steady assault by Congress and the agency government as its thirst for more money grows. regional or local churches are low-hanging fruit, especially since Congress is slowly cutting off their revenue stream. Churches are often on premium properties in high-rent districts, since they were the original founding structures for nearly every American town. Cutting off the people's ability to meet and discuss the issues of the day is also one of the ancillary benefits to Congress. Political speech is not protected in churches if they want to maintain their tax-exempt status. Now you know the long-term game plan that is swiftly being executed by the banks. After all, the taxpayers picking up the bill. Are you starting to feel a little better about your new banking fees? Perhaps not. Well, I'm slowly wiping down the goosebumps on my arms. Pretty scary stuff, people. We're watching it happen right before our eyes, and we feel so powerless. What are they going to come up with next? Well, DARPA, our good friends down at DARPA, now have a robot cheetah that can run faster than you. Looking like a four-legged Star Wars creature, the Pentagon's cheetah robot can gallop up to 18 miles an hour, a land speed record for legged robots. The robot is the product of the Defense Department's Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA. The robot's movements are patterned after those of fast-running animals in nature, stated a news release on DARPA's website. The robot increases its stride and running speed by flexing and unflexing its back on each step, much as an actual cheetah does. These early models are hydraulic, but the military plans to test a free-running prototype later this year. The newer models will literally run using high-gain electromagnetic linear motors. The robot's high speed of 18 miles an hour might not sound all that impressive, but it is nearly 5 miles faster than the previous record of 13.1 miles an hour set in 1989. Also, 18 miles an hour is much faster than the average human jogger, according to Wired magazine. Larger models with IR-guided small-caliber weapons should be able to run about 80 miles an hour within the decade. Solar-recharged mechanimals, as I call them, can lie in remote areas or hidden from sight for months, waiting on orders to strike. Their style of movement makes them virtually impossible to stop with handheld weapons. By the way, just to put this in perspective, the fast man, Usain Bolt, is the human world record holder. He's clocked at 28 miles per hour during the 100-meter sprint in 2009. Humans are the fastest accelerating animals on Earth for the first 40 meters. Mechanimals can reach full speed in less than 3 seconds. And with gyro stabilization, cats use their tails for this function, they may be able to leap 100 feet or more under certain conditions. Boston Dynamics, can you say Cyberdyne Systems, the company behind the Mechano Cheetah, would like the robot to sprint as fast as 60 or 70 miles an hour, the speed of the real cheetah, according to Wired magazine. A cheetah can maintain top speed for about 10 to 15 seconds. Well, depending on battery storage, the Mechanimal can maintain top speed for about 10 minutes, covering about 10 to 12 miles over any terrain. The website reported that DARPA has not yet revealed what the robot will be used for. Let me see. Military use? Along with its eventual high speeds, the device could be designed so that it can zigzag to chase and evade. It could be used for emergency response. Yeah, lots of things need to be chased down in emergencies. Firefighting. Oh, yeah, definitely have to do high-speed evasions in firefighting. Advanced agriculture and vehicular travel. Sure. Well, Earth explorers, let's not rule out warfare and crowd control. Emergency response, I'm sure. Well, interesting story. Interesting story. Now, we have covered on this program a couple of times the Bin Laden raid. Well, today, a news article came out that really blew me away. You know our good friend Julian Assange, right? He was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize right here by X Squared Radio. That nomination has been taken. Has been doubled up. He has been nominated a couple other times for the Nobel Peace Prize. The Nobel Society has not made their mind up who is going to get the Nobel Peace Prize. Our vote is for Julian Assange because he is the spokesperson for an organization called WikiLeaks. Well, very, very interesting stuff. Bin Laden, surprisingly enough, unless you listen to this program, was not buried at sea. I'm shocked. But flown to the U.S. for cremation at a secret location, claims intelligence boss in leaked email. That's right. Emails purported to be obtained by hacker group Anonymous dispute White House version of terror leader's final resting place. Believed to be part of a 2.7 million emails obtained from the intelligence analysis group Stratfor and shared with WikiLeaks. Stratfor calls hackers thieves and says some emails may have been forged or altered. A likely story. WikiLeaks does not do that. They don't need to. They just report it just the way it is. Revelations come as FBI arrests key members of hacking group LulzSec, an offshoot of Anonymous. Well, this article by Thomas Durant will blow you away. Won't blow me away because I guessed it. If you go back 3 months and listen on X Squared Radio, we said exactly the same thing. The fate of Osama bin Laden's remains have been called into question after emails leaked from an intelligence analysis firm say the body of the terror leader was actually sent to the U.S. for cremation. What if he was alive? Terrorist Osama blah, blah, blah. Okay, according to the emails, the Al-Qaeda boss was shot and killed during the famous Navy SEAL Team 6 raid on his compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. He was transported back to the U.S. and cremated. The emails were allegedly obtained by the hacker group Anonymous from Stratfor, an organization dealing with the analysis of intelligence and geopolitical analysis. It's also known as the Shadow CIA. Well, interestingly enough, there's probably more to this because where there's smoke, there's fire. The claims are sure to stoke conspiracy theorists, of which we are not. We just make common sense conclusions based on the facts, especially since the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology that Burton refers to closed its doors on September 15, 2011, 4 months after bin Laden's death. And I have stated on this program that nothing makes sense about the bin Laden raid. Number one, highly trained, armed, and body-armored Navy SEALs raid the man's home, neutralize all resistance. You fill in the blanks there for yourself. And corner an old man and his wife, unarmed, in his pajamas. Unless he was an extremely powerful martial artist, like we see in the movies, the SEALs are unthreatened in any way. Number two, they cannot capture him. They shoot the wife in the leg and shoot the old man in the face. Number three, the SEALs haul the old man into the helicopter, take him out over the ocean, and dump his body. We hollered foul the instant we heard that on this program. None of this made any sense. The SEALs had in their hands the single most valuable intelligence target since Adolf Hitler, and they shot him in the face. Obvious to the most casual observer, due to these actions are the following. Number one, Bin Laden was not there. He had been dead for a long time, but the withholding of that information made it impossible to simply end the prolonged and expensive conflict in Afghanistan. The administration needed an event to justify withdrawal plans, so they staged the execution. Number two, Bin Laden was there, but since he was a CIA-funded and trained asset, his testimony could not be allowed. He was silenced to prevent anyone, including the SEALs, from hearing any of his revelations. Number three, Bin Laden's body was not handled the way the administration disclosed to the public. We now know this for a fact. It appears from the facts that all of this is still on the table. In another email, Mr. Burton said, if the body's dumped at sea, which I doubt, the touch is very Adolf Eichmann-like. The tribe did the same thing with the Nazis' ashes. Eichmann was seen alive for many months on trial before being sentenced to death and executed. No one wanted a monument to him, so they cremated him. Emails purportedly leaked from the intelligence analysis firm Stratfor make mention of Adolf Eichmann, a Nazi lieutenant and a major figure of World War II. After World War II ended in 1945, he was caught by U.S. forces and escaped custody after he gave them a phony name. Eichmann fled to Italy, where he was able to obtain a humanitarian passport. By 1950, he was in Buenos Aires, Argentina, where he lived for years until he was captured, not by the Americans, but by the Israeli spy agency Mossad in 1960. War crimes and crimes against humanity were among the charges he faced when he was found guilty in an Israeli court in 1962. He was hanged, cremated, and his ashes were spread over the Mediterranean Sea. Stratfor CEO George Friedman responded, but I don't know anyone who claimed he wasn't Eichmann. No comparison with suddenly burying him at sea without any chance to view him, which I doubt happened. In a February 27th statement, Stratfor said, in December, thieves compromised Stratfor's data systems and stole a large number of company emails along with other private information of Stratfor readers, subscribers, and employees. Those stolen emails apparently will be published by WikiLeaks. This is a deplorable, unfortunate, and illegal breach of privacy for which he received the Nobel Peace Prize right here on X Squared Radio. Some of the emails may be forged or altered to include inaccuracies. Some may be authentic. We will not validate either. Well, who could expect anything less? Nor will we explain the thinking that went into them. Of course not. Having our property stolen, we will not be victimized twice by submitting to questioning about them. Stratfor, which is not affiliated with the U.S. government, would not comment further. The emails were revealed as it was reported that a member of LulzSec, an offshoot of Anonymous, were arrested by the FBI. An agency official told Fox News that the arrests were a devastating blow to the organization, saying, we're chopping off the head of LulzSec. I doubt that very seriously. The Adolf Eichmann referred to by Burton was a Nazi lieutenant and a major architect of the Holocaust. He slipped through and survived another 15 years, 17 years after the war. Now, last week, hold on one moment while I take a sip of grapefruit juice because I'm responding to you, the listeners. Hold on. Ah, wonderful. Okay. I have been avoiding this, perhaps on purpose, perhaps because I was waiting for more evidence. Well, the evidence is in. And so are your email requests, and I appreciate them. They are not going unheeded. Many of you have asked me to address the truth about Obama's birth certificate. We are not birthers here. I refuse to be labeled a birther. We are Earth explorers, and we look for the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. And one of the more profound mysteries of late has been what Earthlings are doing to Earthlings. Why, I have no idea. Why would anybody go fabricate documents so that they could be president of the United States is beyond me. What is even more beyond me, floors me, flabbergasts me, and stuns me as a scientist, as an engineer, as an explorer, and as an American, is how opponents of this man who ran against him were also passionate about this office did not raise this issue. The press that had in their hands this evidence did nothing about it. The government agencies that we rely upon to vet the documentation of each and every person that runs for this office, mysteriously vacant, absent, fired, gone, clueless, brainless. So I have to cover this, and I'm not going to cover this conspiracy. I'm only going to cover the facts. The claim is that Obama was born to an American citizen in Hawaii, making him a naturally born American. This is factually incorrect. Even if he was born to an American citizen, one parent, in Hawaii, on Hawaiian soil, he doesn't qualify to be president. A naturally born American is born to two American citizens, and he has to be born on American soil. That's precisely why the law was rewritten unconstitutionally to allow John McCain to run for president, because he wasn't born here. Oh, he was born to American citizens, but he was born in Panama on a military base. So the argument was made, well, yes, he was born in Panama, but he was born on a base, and that's really U.S. territory, so he was actually born in America. Congress had to write a special law to make that so that John McCain could run for presidency. It's a good thing he didn't win, because it would have been struck down by the Supreme Court. Congress cannot make a law that violates the Constitution, and that is clearly outlined in the Constitution. Believe me, if one of America's great war heroes could not qualify as a naturally born citizen because he was born in Panama at a military base, there is no way, even if all of these documents are legit, that Obama qualifies. Why there has been no Supreme Court challenge, I will not answer. Well, in June, whether to pressure, which I highly doubt, nobody in their right mind would bend to public pressure. It's meaningless, absolutely meaningless when it comes to being the president. Now, yes, if Congress asked for it, if Senate asked for it, if the Supreme Court asked for it, yes. But if the public asked for it, forget about it. Forget about it. We already had another president do this, and he got away with it. It's true. President Arthur served out his entire 4 years, got beaten the next election, ended up dying before the truth was found out. He was not a naturally born citizen. It's true. And he hid his birth records his entire presidency, even though people were looking for him. He made it. We've been duped before, but he only served one term. Well, in June, the Obama campaign released a digitally scanned image of his birth certificate to quell speculative charges that he might not be a natural-born citizen. But the image prompted more blog-based skepticism about the document's authenticity. And recently, author Jerome Corsi, whose book attacks Obama, said in a TV interview that the birth certificate the campaign has is fake. Well, factcheck.org staffers have now seen, touched, examined, and photographed the original birth certificate. We concluded that it meets all of the requirements from the State Department for proving U.S. citizenship. Claims that the document lacks a raised seal or a signature are false. We have posted high-resolution photographs of the document as supporting documents to this article. Our conclusion? Obama was born in the USA, just as he has always said. Uh-huh. Well, that's a fact. That's a direct observation. These guys went there, they handled it, they published the photographs, and sure enough, everything looks to be legitimate. Well, in the Honolulu Advertiser, November 1st, 2008, the state health director, Dr. Chiome Fukino, said this. This has gotten ridiculous. There are plenty of other important things to focus on, like the economy, taxes, energy. Will this be enough to quiet the doubters? I hope so, Fukino said. We need to get some work done. Fukino said she has personally seen and verified that the Hawaii State Department of Health has Senator Obama's original birth certificate on record in accordance with state policies and procedures. Well, an update. April 27th, 2011, not quite 3 years later, the White House released the long-form version of President Barack Obama's birth certificate, confirming yet again that he was born in the United States. And that release was analyzed very carefully. I have watched all the videos that Sheriff Arpaio had in analyzing this document. And I can tell you, after going through all of this, the results. I think I was going to play the audio to this, but I didn't want to take up my whole program on it. So I'm not going to do that. I can just tell you that there are some anomalies, and I'm going to go into those. The document is a certificate of birth, also known as a short-form birth certificate. The long form is drawn up by the hospital and includes additional information such as birth weight, parents, hometowns. The short form is printed by the state and draws from a database with fewer details. The Hawaii Department of Health's birth record request form does not give the option to request a photocopy of your long-form birth certificate, but their short form has enough information to be acceptable to the State Department. The investigators tried to ask the Hawaii DOH why they only offered the short form, among other questions, but they have not given a response. Now, the scan had some anomalies. The scan released by the campaign shows halos around the black text, making it look to some as though the text might have been pasted on top of an image of security paper. But the document itself has no such halos, nor do the close-up photos we took of it. We conclude that the halo seen in the image produced by the campaign is a digital artifact from the scanning process. Well, I'm just stating these facts for you because we will go into each one of these claims. We asked the Obama campaign about the date stamp and the blacked out certificate number. The certificate is stamped June 2007 because that's when Hawaii officials produced it for the campaign, which requested the document and all records we could get their hands on, according to the spokesperson, Shauna Daly. The campaign didn't release its copy until 2008 after speculation began to appear on the internet questioning Obama's citizenship. The campaign then rushed to release the document, and the rush is responsible for the blacked out certificate number, says Shauna. We couldn't get someone on the phone in Hawaii to tell us whether the number represented some secret information, and we erred on the side of blacking it out. Since then, we found out it's pretty irrelevant for the outside world. The document we looked at did have a certificate number, and they have a photograph of it, and there is no halo around these in the blow up of the photograph. Now, we only see the corner of it. We can't really make out all the details of it. And, of course, they have the birth announcement in the paper. So, the anomalies have to do with how the document was scanned. When the actual file itself is looked at, the entire green security paper background can be deleted, which doesn't happen. Normally, it deletes in several patches called layers. 6 to 8 to 10 layers it takes to get rid of the background because it's grouped together with some of the text during the scanning process. This green background was itself its own layer all by itself. It could be completely deleted. In a scanned document, you cannot grab the date, you can't grab the seal and move it around. It's part of the overall image. Also, if it had been scanned, a lot of the text would show up in text recognition software. None of the text did that. If you want to find this out for yourself, go watch all the videos on Sheriff Arpaio's examination himself and itself, and you can go through it and look at it yourself. I'm not going to cover it anymore on this program. I've gone as far as I'm going to go into it. We're not birthers. I don't care about the birth certificate. I don't care about the Social Security card. And I don't care about the Selective Service card. They could all be forgeries. It does not matter. You have to be born to two U.S. citizen parents on American soil to be a natural born citizen. That's in the Constitution. It had to be that way, and I'll tell you why. Because when the Constitution was drafted, nobody was a natural born citizen. So they added a little clause in the Constitution, a 35-year clause. You have to be 35 years old as of the writing of that agreement. Then and only then would you be exempt from the natural born citizen clause. You had to be born by U.S. Birthed by U.S. parents on this continent. But obviously, they could not be U.S. citizens because there was no United States. So in order for a baby to have been born after 1785, when the ratification of the Constitution took place, you would have to be 35 years of age after 1785. Then and only then would those 4 to 5 words fall out of that article in the Constitution. After that point, all subsequent presidents had to be U.S. born on U.S. soil to two U.S. citizens. That's what the clause means. That's what's it about. And why in the world Obama's opponents, namely Hillary Rodham Clinton, didn't bring this up and make it a major campaign point, I have no idea, unless, of course, it's the fact that she's Secretary of State in the Obama administration. That's all I'm going to say about that. You got things you want to add to that? You want to talk about it with me? It's 888-429-5471. You want to email me? It's bagnew@x2-radio. You want to text me? You can do so through Skype at x2-radio. I'm here. I'll take all questions. I know you're passionate about it. I know that there's a whole movement out there that's interested in vetting the legality and legitimacy of these documents. I'm telling you, people, it doesn't matter. It is a red herring. They're making you chase after smoke and mirrors until his election, until his presidency is over. Concentrate on the law. Concentrate on the Constitution, and you will have it in your grips. Now, Sheriff Arpaio did not investigate this case on a whim. It was done because more than 250 Tea Party members petitioned him to do so. He is there as a sheriff, as a law enforcement officer, along with lawyers, technical experts, and other law enforcement agencies to do questioning, interviews, and gather data to serve his constituents, which are in the state of Arizona. These people have raised a petition that places in question whether or not Mr. Obama will be placed on the ballot in Arizona if it can be shown that the Constitution was not followed, then the violation of the voting rights of the state of Arizona are at question. And the state of Arizona can then take Mr. Obama's name off the ballot. Now, I will tell you what would happen when this occurs. What will happen is the Department of Justice will sue the state of Arizona. They will bring a lawsuit against them to force them to put President Obama's name on the ballot. Arizona will not. It will go to court. And a judge will make a decision. And then it will go to the next level. It will go to the Constitution. It will go to the Supreme Court. Now, the Supreme Court lives for cases like this. They dream their entire career, their entire lawyer career of becoming a Supreme Court justice and having a case like this fall into their laps. These are the landmark cases that go down in history. These are the landmark cases that kings and queens and presidents in other countries watch so carefully. The reason the Supreme Court has not looked at it is because nobody has brought a lawsuit that can make it there. They're all individuals suing. Well, I'm sorry. You don't have a dog in the fight. The Supreme Court's not going to hear you. But the state of Arizona does. The state of Arizona has a dog in the fight because their ballot is about to be violated by a man who does not qualify to be president, and they know it. And so they are going to refuse to put him on the ballot, which is going to precipitate the lawsuit by the Department of Justice, and this case will go to the Supreme Court. And we'll cover it right here on X Squared Radio. You will see the Constitution tested over what it means to be a natural born citizen. Not a naturalized citizen, not a citizen, but a natural born citizen. Very clearly, the founding fathers knew exactly what they were doing when they put this clause in there. They only wanted people that had the best interest of the United States of America in mind, especially when going to war with a country with whom they might have a prior affiliation through family ties. It's exactly why that clause was in there. Remember, they were about to go to war with the largest, most well-funded, most feared army in the history of the world, the British. That's why it's in there, folks. That's why that clause is there, because the founding fathers foresaw this day when a charismatic man would run for president who was not qualified to be president, and we would elect him anyway. Okay. Now, the big fix. It's true. Elections can be stolen with no fingerprints. About 3 months ago, we broke the story to you that SCYTL, SCYTL, is the global leader in online voting solutions with a presence in over 20 countries. SOE Software is the leading software company for election management solutions in the United States. The combination of the two companies creates the industry leader in election software with a strong market presence worldwide. SCYTL, the global leader in secure electronic voting technologies, announced today the acquisition of 100% of the SOE Software, the leading software provider of election management solutions in the U.S. Now, SCYTL is currently the worldwide leader in the internet voting space, and the acquisition of SOE Software with its Clarity election management software suite significantly expands SCYTL's product portfolio beyond electronic voting. Furthermore, SOE Software's strong U.S. presence with 900 jurisdictions as customers in 26 states, including 14 statewide customers, complements very effectively Skytel's customer base in the United States and internationally with customers in over 20 countries across five continents, including France, Spain, Canada, Norway, Switzerland, South Africa, United Arab Emirates, Mexico, India, and Australia. We have now learned through legal testimony before Congress that vote flipping code has been entered into vote tallying software. You're going to hear it first right here. There are some key things that place doubt as to whether electronic vote tallying can ever be reliable. What you are about to hear is a NASA and DOT programmer who is testifying before a congressional inquiry about the integrity of the vote tallying software. What you are about to hear, you, I'm sure, have never heard before. Listen closely to this testimony. It will blow you away.
Mr. Curtis, would you please state your full name for the record?
My name is Clinton Eugene Curtis.
And where do you reside?
Tallahassee, Florida.
And what is your profession?
I'm a computer programmer.
Would you please speak into the microphone so the audience can hear your testimony?
I'm a computer programmer.
Mr. Curtis, are there programs that can be used to secretly fix elections?
Yes.
How do you know that to be the case?
Because in October of 2000, I wrote a prototype for President Congressman Tom Feeney at the company I worked for in Oviedo, Florida, that did just that.
And when you say did just that, it would rig an election?
It would flip the vote 51-49, to whoever you wanted it to go to and whichever race you wanted to win.
And would that program that you designed be something that elections officials that might be on county boards of elections could detect?
They'd never see it.
Mr. Would you answer that question once again?
They would never see it.
So how would such a program, a secret program that fixes the election, how could it be detected?
You would have to view it either in the source code or you'd have to have a receipt and then count the hard paper against the actual vote total. Other than that, you won't see it.
All right, Mr. Curtis, if you had been asked, you or others with your professional expertise had been asked to design a protective program that would protect the Ohio elections from against such software to fix the election, could you have done so?
If we've been asked to make a program that could fix the election, sure, anybody can do it.
No, could you have designed a program or a procedure or a protocol that would have protected Ohio against this kind of rigging?
No, you have to look at the source code. You have to get probably programmers from both or all parties to look at the source code and determine if there's anything in there that shouldn't be there. I mean, it's a simple program. You're adding one to a person's total. It's 100 lines of code tops.
All right. Are you aware of whether there was any protective action in Ohio against this kind of vote rigging through software?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
You were not asked to assist in the development of any protective system, is that correct?
No, I was not.
In Europe, have you reviewed at all the election results in Ohio?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Given the availability of such vote rigging software and the testimony that has been given under oath of substantial statistical anomalies and gross differences between exit polling data and the actual tabulated results, do you have an opinion whether or not the Ohio election, presidential election, was hacked?
Yes, I would say it was. I mean, if you have exit polling data that is significantly off from the vote, then it's probably hacked.
And your testimony is under oath?
Yes, sir.
And the testimony you've given is true?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
It isn't over. They're going to ask more questions here in just a moment. It gets even deeper.
Congresswoman Waters and I have the same question.
Come back to the podium.
Who did you say you were asked to prepare?
I was asked by Tom Feeney. He's now a congressman. At that time, he was Speaker of the House of Florida, Yang Enterprises, which is the company I work for, lobbyist, and their corporate attorney. wore a lot of hats.
And at the time, he was the Speaker of the House of Florida. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Congressman.
You say he was the lobbyist for the voting machine company at the same time he was Speaker of the House?
I don't know what the voting machine company is. He was a lobbyist for Yang Enterprises. We had NASA contracts.
And Yang Enterprises did what? Computers?
Computers.
Okay, and he was your lobbyist. Your company.
He was a lobbyist for that company, yes.
And he asked you to design a code to rig an election?
Yes.
While he was Speaker of the Florida House?
Yes.
This was during or previous to the 2000 election?
Yes, October, end of September.
And did he ever express why he wanted a code to rig an election?
No, I immediately assumed that they were trying to keep you guys from cheating them. So I wrote up the documentation of what you would look for in the source code, how you would make sure that you didn't get, taken advantage of, make sure that all voting machines had receipts, because that way you could back count the ones that looked a little funny. And I handed it over.
By receipts, you mean a paper trail?
Yes, a paper trail. And I handed that in to Mrs. Yang and said, here's your report, here's your program. And she said, you don't understand, we need to hide the fraud in the source code.
Hide the fraud, not reveal the fraud.
Not reveal the fraud, because it's needed to control the vote in South Florida, is what she said.
Whoa. That's what she said. That's what your knowledge, was this used?
I have no idea. I was ready to leave, so I retired and left the company.
Your testimony a moment ago, I think you said just before you left, that answered the Congresswoman Pledger Jones' question. Would you just repeat what you said in terms of the exit polls?
Oh, the exit polls should not be significantly different than the vote.
And if they were, you would conclude what?
I would conclude someone's playing with the vote.
Now with the exit polls?
That's possible, too.
Okay,
something is definitely skewed.
Something is skewed in one or the other about.
Right. To select which one, you'd have to see where the problem is.
Let me ask you one further question. Assuming for the moment that such software, that's what you call it, such software to rig a vote was used in one or more machines in Ohio or in Florida, could you today detect that if you looked at the source code?
If you get the machines and they have not been patched yet, once they get in and touch them, anything can happen. You can also set timers to do that, but then you see the timers. Then you'd have to take those machines, decompile them, which I couldn't do, but possibly a Microsoft, an MIT, something could do. You might be able to see it.
You might.
Not depends on how good they are at destroying what they had.
Destroying what they had by tampering with the machine afterwards or by programming a destroyed instruction in the first place.
Right, because since you didn't...
Either or both.
You didn't actually see what's in there, so you don't know if the code is running in a single executable or running in various modules. If it's running in modules, you can make the code actually eat itself.
Let me ask you one further question. I've been told that people who assume that lots of the election results, or that a large fraction of the election result in this state may have been affected by deliberate fraud in the computer are paranoid, because in order to do that, you'd have to have access to thousands of machines, and that would be readily detectable. To what extent is that true?
It depends on the technology you use. If you did a central tabulation machine that fed in, all you'd have to do is set a flag. You set a flag, the central central tabulation machine would then flip your vote.
So one person putting in bad code in a central tabulation machine could affect thousands and thousands or tens of thousands of votes.
Right. And you could activate it automatically, or you could make it so that there's code existing on like an electronic machine that feeds it, where you would punch it in, it would set the flag, the server would see the flag, and then...
And if you had a recount, and there were no paper trail, assuming that that had happened, would that be revealable by seeing a discrepancy between what the central tabulator showed and what the individual machines, which had not been tampered with, showed?
Not if I wrote it.
Why not? In other words,
I would make it match.
You could work back from the tabulator to the individual machines, so the tabulator would tell the machines to switch their results.
Yes, talks both ways. You can flip it whatever you need.
And they actually can talk to each other.
As long as it's networked together, they can talk to each other.
So in other words, there's absolutely no assurance whatsoever in anything with regard to these machines.
Absolutely none, unless you look at the source code and make sure it's safe before it comes out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, it's not done yet. There'll be a little bit of applause, and he's going to come right back. I know, I want to interrupt. I'm really tempted to, but this stuff is so powerful. You need to hear it.
I knew this.
As you know, there has been a lot of discussion about, I think it was Diebold.
This is Maxine Waters.
Company, their relationship to the president and the administration, and supposedly comments about helping to ensure that the president was reelected. In your world, in your environment, have you heard any of this kind of discussion? Do you know people who work for the world? Do you have any sense of any actions that may have been taken?
I don't know anything about that at all.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, I suspect people will attack you in terms of your credibility. Could you restate once again your credentials?
I'm a programmer. I work for NASA, work for ExxonMobil, work for Florida Department of Transportation, and other elements of my story, because this company, let's get into it, why not? This company also, they have NASA contracts, and they were basically downloading tons of information, I mean gigabytes worth, and handing them off to this little Chinese guy named Henry Nee, and it didn't seem right, and you know, he was hacking things, and I wrote a program for DOT that allowed contractors to send their information into DOT, and he was kind of the quality assurance guy for software. He put a wiretapping module in the program that went out to the contractor so that it actually sent everything they sent back to Yang. So I reported all this, and just last March, I think, he was arrested for attempting to send anti-tank missile chips to the capital of Communist China. So if that's correct, this is such a small thing. Of course, I think he only got a $100 fine. And no time.
Thank you. Thank you. Congresswoman Stephanie Tupps Jones.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So now there are congressmen and senators in this meeting during this testimony. So now you have heard that not only can the vote flip software be written to where it flips the vote of the person who cast the vote, it also talks back to the voting machine itself so that if the tally is cross-checked against the original electronic vote, they match. And then the software eats itself, which means it goes away. It cannot be traced. So, in any case, the only true and irrefutable vote is the personal face-to-face vote that is live. Our election process of a Republican candidate is being manipulated every way possible. You've seen that. Counties with very large voting blocks are being disqualified. Votes are reported late in a blatant attempt to influence the next primary or caucus. And no one really knows how the primary will come out. Why? Well, I have a reality check clip that will explain it better. This is an outfit called Reality Check. They do a wonderful job. I want you to listen closely and see if you can figure out what's going on with this Republican primary.
The AP and Fox News have their numbers. Well, what are those numbers based upon and how accurate are they? Well, Ben has a reality check.
Well, let's start by pointing out that winning states is really not the contest here. Winning delegates is. Last night, during their Super Tuesday election coverage, a number of news outlets have started reporting delegate numbers. Now, remember, the number all candidates are trying to get to is 1,144 delegates to secure the Republican nomination for president. According to, for instance, let's say election 2012 GOP delegate tracker, it's the Wall Street Journal site, Mitt Romney has a sizable lead with 415 delegates. Santorum is second with 176 delegates. Newt Gingrich is third with 105 delegates. And Ron Paul is a distant fourth with 47 delegates. So where do those numbers actually come from? Well, about half of them are guesses. Let me try to explain where these numbers come from. So far, there have been 20 statewide contests, either primaries or caucuses. In some states, the process is a binding vote, meaning the delegates are automatically assigned to a candidate if that candidate wins a state outright and if they win in that state's congressional districts. But in other states, these contests are non-binding, meaning the selection of delegates really has nothing to do with who wins the vote. I'll show you what I mean in a minute. But first, let's talk about what we do know. Some states like Florida, they make it really easy. This year, Florida has 50 delegates. They are bound delegates, which means it's a truly winner-take-all. Mitt Romney won Florida. So when those 50 delegates go to the convention in Tampa, they must, on the first round of voting, vote for Romney. Here's how the numbers break down. Romney won 7 in New Hampshire, 50 in Florida, 38 in Massachusetts, just to name a few, and at least 13 in Ohio. From the numbers we know, Romney has at least 244 delegates. Clearly, he has the most of these winner-take-all states. The other candidates look like this. Newt Gingrich had a big win in South Carolina for 23 delegates. Also, his win in Georgia last night gives him 23 more delegates, though he'll likely pick up even more as the congressional districts are counted. Gingrich also got 6 in Nevada as well. He sits at 52 delegates. Santorum, well, he won 3 in Nevada, 14 in Michigan, and because he did not qualify for delegates in all the congressional districts in Ohio, it's really unclear how many he actually picked up last night. So we do know that Santorum has at least 17 delegates. But he also won Oklahoma and Tennessee last night. Those are proportional states with 95 delegates between them to be split up. And then there's Ron Paul, who hasn't won a single contest. Nevertheless, he's been picking up delegates. He grabbed 3 in New Hampshire, 5 in Nevada, 3 in Virginia. That totals 11 delegates. He also finished 2nd in North Dakota and Washington and Vermont, which are all proportional states, meaning he'll pick up additional bound delegates there as well. Now, that was the easy part. So here's where all the conjecture comes in. Of the 20 contests thus far, 7 of them are non-binding straw polls. That essentially means that it doesn't matter who wins the caucus vote, because the delegates are allowed to vote for any candidate they choose. That means there are 28 from Iowa, 36 from Colorado, 40 from Minnesota, 24 from Maine, 29 from Wyoming, and 40 from Washington. That comes to 197 unbound delegates. Those delegates, again, can vote for any candidate they choose. So the real question becomes, who are those delegates going to vote for? Well, no one really knows. But the two campaigns with the most organization are the Romney campaign and the Paul campaign. In fact, you've probably heard people asking why Ron Paul was still in the race, having not won a single contest. There are reports from all of these unbound states that his supporters are the ones snatching up the majority of those 197 delegate spots. So here's what you need to know. Santorum says he's not out. Gingrich says he isn't going anywhere. And Paul says that he's winning. That's because there is a lot of race left. About 34 more contests still to be held, including contests in Puerto Rico and Guam. So how far will this go? Well, who knows? But the last time a Republican candidate didn't make it to the convention, already locking up the needed delegates, it was 1976, when then-Governor Ronald Reagan nearly pulled a coup and took the nomination away from Gerald Ford. And he nearly did it by picking up all of those unbound delegates. And that is reality check.
It can be done. It can be done. That's exactly why this race is not over yet. Now, the interesting thing about this voting software now, just recently, it's all controlled in a foreign country. If that vote flipping software is written there and those precincts one by one begin reporting, the software can talk back to the tally machines, rewriting the vote, gather up the tally, and shift the vote 5, even 10%, and it's absolutely untraceable. It cannot be traced, and you just heard testimony before Congress and the Senate that not only can it be done, It was requested to be done by the Speaker of the House of the state of Florida. It doesn't get any better than that, does it, my friends? Now, there's some things that that we win and some things that we lose. We're just not going to take a break because it's my program, and I'm just deciding that we're going to carry right on through. If I take a break now, I'm going to lose my pace. It's important that we stay on task. One of the things that we know right now is that there's a lunar lander firing up for touchdown. It's true. It sounds like 1969 all over again, but this time the USA is left out in the cold. Europe's ambition of touching down at the moon's south pole by 2018 has been boosted by recent test firings of the craft's thrusters. The robot lander will prove new techniques for sending humans to the moon and assess lunar hazards. With no atmosphere on the moon, actually there is an atmosphere, it's just very light, lunar lander cannot rely on parachutes to slow its descent. Instead, the craft will need to fire its engines in a rather unconventional way. One of these thrusters was recently put through its paces at Astrium's specialized facility in Lampoldshausen, Germany. The test chamber was configured to reproduce the vacuum and temperatures that lunar lander will face on its way down to the moon's surface, with, of course, the exception that it had gravity. A complete descent and touchdown was simulated, with the thruster firing in a series of short bursts, reaching a white-hot 1,100 degrees C, according to ESA's Berengaria Hudau. The results are positive. The thruster's operations went smooth and stable with great performance. If it didn't, well, no big deal, because it was all suspended by cables anyway, so, but they would have learned a lot. The automated transfer vehicle is a space ferry. It has already completed two fully automated missions to the International Space Station, delivering supplies and boosting the complex to a higher orbit. The third ATV is set for launch this month, but landing on the moon is very different from docking with the space station. Before these tests, it was unclear whether the thrusters would be suitable for a lunar voyage. Now they know it is. Ahead of landing, the craft will orbit the moon some 100 kilometers above the surface to descend to the moon's southern pole. Central engines will fire for 10 minutes as the ATV thrusters steer the spacecraft to a safe landing. There's no GPS for the moon because we don't have any satellites around it, so the lunar lander will navigate by digitally imaging the surface and recognizing features. A laser will complete the picture to avoid hazards such as boulders and craters at the target site. The lunar lander's powerful processor will make intelligent decisions to search for a safe area and touch down without any human help. European technology will be used throughout. My question is, and you can chime in if you want to, I encourage you to, 888-429-5471. My question is, why is the U.S. coming in last in the tech race? I mean, there's a huge sucking sound, Earth Explorers. The brains of America are being sucked out of the country like factories were in 1993 after the signing of the North American Free Trade Agreement by President Clinton. Except that now it isn't cheap labor that is the main attraction. It's better technology. Are they just stealing the technology we have here? Hardly. The truth is that America has a secret weapon that has kept it at the technology front for many decades. And it's not because of the superior cranial capabilities of American kids. We have a secret weapon, and the person that's going to discuss that secret weapon is none other than spokes scientist Michio Kaku. He's one of my colleagues. I trust him. I trust his viewpoint, and he's pretty passionate about it. This is a panel discussion where he is, being contentious, and he's going to tell you what America's secret weapon is. Listen up.
The U.S. military is warning oil output may dip and cause massive shortages by 2015. So what does this mean? And why is the U.S. military coming out with this prediction? Here to weigh in is investigative journalist Webster Tarpley. Webster, thank you so much for being here.
That is not the right clip. That is not the right clip. I don't think that is the right clip. Hang on a second. Let me jump ahead here because I think it's supposed to be Michio Kaku. Hold on.
Well, counter gang, some would say.
Nope, not right clip. Let me explain to you what the secret weapon is. I would find the clip for you, but I don't want to waste time doing it. Sorry, I will fire myself after the program and then rehire myself next week. Don't worry about it. The secret weapon is called the H-1B. No, it's not a machine. It's a piece of paper. It's called the Genius Passport. The H-1B is a clause. The Genius Visa. It's a clause that allows us to import PhDs and PhD candidates from other countries. Oh, yeah. They've been coming here for decades under the H-1B visa. They get the education, and then they return back to their country. And they take their brains with them. The new Fisker electric vehicle is being built in Finland with nearly $500 million loan guarantee provided by the American taxpayer. The conservatives are outraged, say the press. But the truth is that Mr. Fisker is no loser. He is smart and aggressive and has gone to dozens of contract manufacturers in America in an attempt to get his electric car built and to market. He even agreed to buy the old GM plant from the bankruptcy court to appease Vice President Joe Biden's district so he could get the loan guarantee. Well, the union plant in Wilmington, Delaware was nowhere nearly efficient enough to build this vehicle, and Mr. Fisker couldn't get the tech support he needed without huge tariffs and delays from U.S. Customs and Border Protection, so he left town. The brains and technology were in Finland, and the car is now in production. Mr. Fisker will do one thing no independent car company has ever done. It will pay back his loans. This is why our space program is in China and Europe. This is why virtually all drugs, computer programs, architectural advances, geological and physics breakthroughs, and the brains for our professors and scientists comes from outside the U.S. What is America doing wrong? Well, it isn't the American local school system that is at fault. I can tell you that. I've been on an acting member of school board. At one time, I had a kid in every school in my county. I can tell you it is the Department of Education that is at fault. The Department of Education consumes over $1 billion a year and doesn't educate a single student. School choice is not allowed in 99% of the country. School curricula is now programmed to fit the federal tests, which are written or vetted by a presidential task force headed up by, you guessed it, union officials. The entire U.S. government educational system, which means your K through 12 schools, not colleges, are geared toward producing workers, not thinkers. President Clinton's Education Edge, which was a Goals 2000 program, was designed to shift the schools away from teaching kids how to learn and toward teaching them how to work in teams and get a job. Every attempt by parents who see what is happening to their schools to produce a superior educational opportunity has been blocked or sued into oblivion. School voucher programs are working and have proven that students who can choose their school with a voucher make a better school, just out of the competitive market forces at work. The best teachers are sought after to make the best schools so that they can attract the voucher money. Now, I will say that the cities and counties, and actually mostly county budgets, cities don't usually have budgets for schools, but the counties do. I can tell you that the counties are making money. And it is because the voucher is actually for less money than they actually receive in taxes for the student. Let's just say, for example, that a county receives $10,000 in taxes for each student that goes to school. They only give a voucher for $7,500. So they get to keep $2,500. The parent of that child gets to take that voucher to the school of their choice and enroll their student. And the amazing thing is that the students that are enrolled in these programs are doing better than the students that were in their previous schools. They're excelling at the tests. This is the program that could be used to save the K through 12 school systems. In the state of North Carolina, where I live, the K through 12 schools are deplorable. When my kids moved here from Tennessee, which is ranked 17th in the country, they coasted, literally coasted, sitting on their hands for 2 years because they knew so much more of the material than the students the same grade in North Carolina, which ranks about 37th in the country for K through 12. The teachers' union is a strong financial supporter. And the best teachers, it can only be determined through performance-based testing. And the teachers' union is against anything close to performance-based measurement of teachers. They're also strong financial supporters of Democrats, which also has a revolving door with the leadership positions of the U.S. Department of Education. Now, I support openly on this program Ron Paul and Newt Gingrich, who have openly promised they will close the Department of Education within 12 months of their inauguration. It should be closed. End of story. The federal government has no business being involved in K through 12. That is a state function. Make the states compete against each other. Make the schools in those states compete against each other. And make the teachers compete against each other, just like engineers do. In every company, the best engineers are never out of work. The best teachers can make a huge difference. It may already be too late. Now, there is a storm brewing. If you don't believe me, you can open up almost any online newspaper today. The story didn't break until today, and I'm bringing it to you right here. Leon Panetta. No, he is not a guitar player. He is the Secretary of Defense. He has a new War Powers Act. That sounds kind of strange, doesn't it? Because we already have a War Powers Act. This one is going to blow you away. Are you sitting down? I know you are, because that's the way we start every X Squared Radio program. Recline your chair, look out the window, because we are about to launch. Here we go. Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Martin Dempsey testified at a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing Wednesday that the Obama administration would seek international permission before intervening militarily into Syria's civil war. Both men left open, however, the question of whether the approval of Congress would even be sought or required. Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican from Alabama, pressed Panetta repeatedly on that question. But in text, it says they failed to get a definitive answer. I cannot help it. I have to play you this clip. Because if I play you this clip, you're going to hear for yourself the most unbelievable testimony you've ever heard. And then I'm going to break the news story. This is going to blow you away if you have not heard it. This is Leon Panetta.
General Dempsey, you
and Dempsey.
And one of your criteria for determining...
this is Senator Jeff Sessions.
Militarily, you say you have to ask the question whether the action is worth the cost and is consistent with law. What law does the United States military look to?
Yeah, if I could, since I'd like to address both because they are related. So cost, resources, risk incurred elsewhere by the use of force one other place. So, you know, it's a zero-sum game. We take them from someplace else, we use them for how long, and that's the kind of issue of cost. Is it? And, of course, in blood and treasure. The issue of legal basis is important, though. We act with the authorized use of military force either at the consent of a government, so we're invited in, or out of national self-defense, there's a very clear criteria for that. And then the last one is with some kind of international legal basis, an UNSCR.
Wait a minute. Let's talk about an international legal basis. You answer under the Constitution to the United States government, do you not? And you don't need any international support before you would carry out a military operation authorized by the commander.
No, of course not. That's the second one.
I just want to know that because there's a lot of references in here to international matters before we make a decision. And I want to be sure that the United States military understands, and I know you do, that we're not dependent on a NATO resolution or UN resolution to execute policies consistent with the national security of the United States.
So,
now, Secretary Panetta, you, in your talk, in your remarks...
Now, this is Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta.
First, we're working to increase diplomatic isolation and encouraging other countries to join the European Union and Arab League in imposing sanctions. And then you note that China and Russia have repeatedly blocked the UN Security Council from taking action. Are you saying, and is the president taking that position, he would not act if it was in our interest to do so if the UN Security Council did not agree?
When it comes to the kind of military action where we want to build a coalition and work with our international partners, then obviously we would like to have some kind of legal basis on which to do it as we did in Libya.
Now, some sort of legal basis. We worried about international legal basis, but nobody worried about the fundamental constitutional legal basis that this Congress has over war. We were not asked stunningly in direct violation of the War Powers Act, whether or not you believe it's constitution, it certainly didn't comply with it. We spent our time worrying about the UN, the Arab League, NATO, and too little time, in my opinion, worried about the elected representatives of the United States. Do you think that you can act without Congress to initiate a no-fly zone in Syria without congressional approval?
You know, again, our goal would be to seek international permission, and we would come to the Congress and inform you and determine how best to approach this, whether or not we would want to get permission from the Congress. I think those are issues we would have to discuss as we decide what to do here.
Well, I'm almost breathless about that, because what I heard you say is we're going to seek international approval, and they will come and tell the Congress what we might do, and we might seek congressional approval.
No, well,
I want to just say to you, that's a big dish. Wouldn't you agree, you've served in the Congress,
yeah.
Wouldn't you agree that that's would be pretty breathtaking to the average American? So would you like to clarify that?
But I've also served with Republican presidents and Democratic presidents who have always reserved the right to defend this country if necessary.
But you, before we do this, you would seek permission of the international authorities.
If we're working with an international coalition and we're working with NATO, we would want to be able to get appropriate permissions in order to be able to do that. That's something that, you know, all of these countries would want to have some kind of legal basis on which to act.
What legal basis are you looking for? What entity?
Well, obviously, if NATO made the decision to go in, that would be one. If we developed an international coalition beyond NATO, then obviously some kind of UN security resolution would be the basis for that.
A coalition of So you're saying NATO would give you a legal basis and an ad hoc coalition of nations would provide a legal basis?
If we were able to put together a coalition were able to move together, then obviously we would seek whatever legal basis we would need in order to make that justified. I mean, you know, we can't just pull them all together in a combat operation without getting the legal basis on which to act.
Who are you asking for the legal basis from?
If it's obviously, if the UN passed a security resolution as it did in Libya, we would do that. If NATO came together as we did in Bosnia, we would rely on that. So, you know, we have options here if we want to build the kind of international approach to dealing with the situation.
Well, I'm for all for having an international support, but I'm really baffled by the idea that somehow an international assembly provides a legal basis for the United States military to be deployed in combat. I don't believe it's close to being correct. They can provide no legal authority. The only legal authority that's required to deploy the United States military is the Congress and the President and the law and the Constitution.
Let me just for the record be clear again, Senator, so there's no misunderstanding. When it comes to the national defense of this country, the President of the United States has the authority under the Constitution to act to defend this country, and we will. If it comes to an operation where we're trying to build a coalition of nations to work together to go in and operate as we did in Libya or Bosnia, for that matter, Afghanistan, we want to do it with permissions either by NATO or by the international community.
All right, so you have the gist of it there. Very clearly there at the end, Mr. Panetta stating the president's position. I can just tell you right now that it's flat out unconstitutional. Everyone who's heard this believes it. And I have to tell you, I am so proud to be in North Carolina. Two elected officials have made me even more proud. One is Congressman Larry Kissel. Even though the President of the United States has vetoed the Keystone Pipeline, Larry Kissel introduced a bill and has led the charge to approve the Keystone Pipeline, and it will be approved. It will be approved regardless of the president not accepting it. Secondly, Representative Walter B. Jones Jr., by the way, Larry Kissel's a Democrat, going against his own president to get this passed. Walter B. Jones Jr., a Republican from North Carolina, has introduced a resolution based on this testimony and other intentions, which you're going to hear about in the next couple of days. You may not have heard this yet. This is brand spanking new. It has introduced a resolution declaring that should the president use offensive military force without authorization of an act of Congress, not the UN, not NATO, not the Arab League, not any ad hoc organization of coalition partners, but without an authorization of an act of Congress, it is the sense of Congress that such an act would be an impeachable high crime and misdemeanor. Specifically, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution reserves for Congress alone, not the president, the power to declare war, a restriction that has been sorely tested in recent years, to be sure, including Mr. Obama's authorization of military force in Libya. Congress didn't even know about it, let alone were they consulted. They didn't even know that American forces were on the ground in Libya in combat situations, and they were. Well, I could just tell you that U.S. Representative Tom Tancredo claims that Jones introduced his House Concurrent Resolution 107 in response to startling recent comments that you just heard from Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta. This week, it was Secretary of Defense Panetta's declaration before Senate Armed Services Committee that he and President Obama look not to Congress for authorization to bomb Syria, but to NATO and the United Nations. This led to Representative Walter Jones Jr.'s introduction of an official resolution calling for impeachment should Obama take offensive action based on Panetta's policy statement because it would violate the Constitution. I will tell you right now here on this program that this resolution will be met head on by a challenge by Mr. Obama. He will commit forces in Syria. He will go around Congress to do it, and he will dare them to impeach him. Dare them to impeach him. Watch for it in the news, and you're hearing about it right here, right now. You have any opinion on it? I would love to hear it. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. You've heard the testimony yourselves. You've heard everything you need to hear to make your own decisions about this. And I can tell you that this is earth-shaking. It is earth-shaking for the Constitution. It's earth-shaking for the faith and credit and integrity of the United States of America. It's earth-shaking for the Constitution, the oldest Constitution in history, the oldest Constitution on the earth right now, and it is hanging by a thread. Hanging by a thread. The War Powers Resolution referenced by Sessions was passed by Congress in 1973. After President Nixon had been waging secret wars in Laos and Cambodia. It forbids sending U.S. forces into military action abroad without authorization of Congress, except in case of a national emergency created by an attack on the United States, its territories or possessions, or its armed forces. It further requires the President to notify Congress within 48 hours of deploying troops. In such an emergency. Let's see. Ted writes me, very good of you to bring this matter up. First I've heard of it was yesterday, and I'm stunned at his admission. There is an interesting correlation between these statements and the new and very rushed-in legislation, like certain provisions in the NDAA and the recent anti-protest bill now being tabled. The U.S. has not brought in a law that they've never used. So what is it that they now know that we don't? So much so that they need new laws like this. Ted, I'm going to do some investigation and find out about the anti-protest bill, because the founding fathers saw all of this coming. I am writing a new book, which is going to be out in, I'm going to say, no more than 2 months. It is going to press in 2 months or less. I promise you. I'm working on it every day. It is called Alienated Nation, the Agency-Driven Government. You're going to love it. It has a lot of this stuff in it. It is not so political, but it is very, very constitutional. I've been wanting to write this for a long time. And I have to tell you that the founding fathers, many things have been said about them of late by many daytime and nighttime talk radio hosts, not on this program, that the founding fathers could not have seen this day, that they didn't foresee any of the progress, any of the growth, any of the size, or any of the dynamism of this nation. I beg to differ. They were already part of the largest global kingdom in the history of the world. It was said the sun never set on the British Empire. These men came from it. They were funded by it. They were sent by it. They escaped it. They knew exactly what would happen if one man got too much power. It is precisely why they wrote the Constitution the way that they did. They foresaw this America exactly, and they wrote the Constitution to prevent this America from coming to power. It is now coming to power. And as Ted has just told us, there's a new anti-protest bill. It's now being tabled. Tabled means it's not going to be brought out onto the floor. I'm sure certain amendments will be made to it, and certain it'll probably slid into another larger bill somewhere. The anti-protest bill is specifically aimed at the Occu Party. It is designed to get people who are making political speech out of the public parks and off of the public streets and sidewalks of our nation. I have to tell you, free speech is specifically outlined in the words of the Constitution. It is political speech that is protected. It is exactly this kind of speech that is protected. No, you can't holler fire in a movie theater. Speech has its consequences, but you are not prevented from making it. You are not prevented from protesting. And any law that limits it is going to be seen to further alienate this nation, and that's why I'm writing the book. It's called Alienated Nation. I promise you it will be out by the end of April. I'm working on it every day, and it is coming together so quickly. You have it right here, right now. The joint resolution of the War Powers Act was passed by a 2/3 vote of Congress over President Nixon's veto and has been ignored ever since, most notably during President Clinton's bombing of Bosnia in 1999 and by President Obama's air war in Libya in 2011. In his testimony Wednesday, Panetta, you just heard him, stressed the importance of getting international permission for taking military action, relegating the approval of Congress, should it be sought at all, to the status of a national afterthought. Well, we're not going to take it anymore. Now we have two great leaders from the state of North Carolina. We already see that this new resolution, it's been drafted, it has gone to the floor. Representative Walter B. Jones, the resolution declaring that should the president use offensive military force without authorization of an act of Congress, it will be a high crime and misdemeanor. This time, the line is drawn in the sand on the floor of Congress. And I can tell you right here on this program, the president won't even walk up to that line. He will jump over it. This will precipitate military action in Syria and Iran quicker than a strike on our own property, because this challenge is the challenge this president lives for. He wants this fight. And you know and I know where this fight will go. It will go to the Constitution, and it will, or to the Supreme Court, and it will split this country wide open, not on the basis of the Constitution, but on another basis that I am not willing to cover on this program. Thank you, Ted, for your note. I hope that I read it word for word. We appreciate every contribution to this program. My phone number is 888-429-5471. We have about 6 minutes left in this program. I encourage you, make notes, because next week I'll be back and I'll have some more information on this. I'm going to be digging because, like Goldie Hawn said in Private Benjamin, I'm going to be watching them like a hawk. And you're going to hear about it right here. No, we don't do conspiracy theories. You know that. You have my word on it. But we will vet the facts. We will talk about direct observations. And this is political science at its best. And I promise you, you're going to enjoy learning things here on this program. We try to do it from a positive point of view. And sometimes the news is so stunning, so shocking, so unbelievably, brazenly anti-constitutional. We just have to tell it like it is. So I can just tell you, I really appreciate your being here. I appreciate your words. I appreciate your emails. Don't forget to write me, bagnew@x2-radio.com. I will be speaking at two conferences this year, one in Southern Indiana, the Pythagoras Conference in October. Click on the blue banner at x2radio.com. You'll get $100 off. You don't have to fly anywhere. You can drive to it. Come on, it's in the Midwest. When do we have great conferences like this in the Midwest? Never. You can be part of it. Or you can go with me to Chichen Itza in Mexico, ground zero for this entire 2012 saga, the whole thing. Oh, I have one piece of news, one piece of news. On my screenplay of the Ark of Millions of Years, the screenplay is called Birth, okay? B-E-A-R-T-H. It's copyrighted, so don't even think about it. It was pre-read by university script writers. Over 100 people read this big box of scripts, and then they decide which one is the best script of the year. Guess what? That's right. Birth, number one. We're heading to Hollywood with the script. So maybe it'll be a major motion picture before you know it. I promise I'll bring the best leading edge stuff I can muster right here on X Squared Radio. Thank you so much for being part of the program. We'll see you next week right here east of the Appalachians in an undisclosed location. Don't forget to turn your clocks forward if you didn't last night, or you're going to wake up tomorrow morning for work very confused. 1 hour forward, people. See you next week. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.